Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. This program is one in a mini-series that University Matters on Campus FM is doing on the Faculty for the Built Environment. And this is on the occasion of the faculty's centenary celebrations this year. It's been 100 years a faculty. Changed its name since the beginning, but still it's enjoying its centenary, which is quite a milestone. I'm happy to have with me today two members of the faculty, Professor Joanne Kassar, who is head of the Department of Conservation and Built Heritage within the Faculty for the Built Environment, and Professor Dione Buhajar, who is a professor within the Civil Structural Engineering Department of the same faculty. Professor Buhajar's interests range from buckling of thin-walled, cold-formed sections, pre-stressed concrete design, glass structures, building waste recycling, about which we shall probably be speaking mostly today, and something called connection design. Professor Kassar's research interests range from conservation education to conservation science. She's actually a scientist, really. Composition and properties of stone, deterioration of building materials, conservation of building materials, and conservation of archaeological sites. And we shall be talking about a mixture of those things, I think, today. I'm going to ask Professor Buhajar to give us a little picture, really, of the importance of stone in Malta, particularly to the economy, really. And although we're not going to be going into chemical and technical details, perhaps give us an indication of the main stone, types of stone that we have actually on the island.
Limestone and Malta is the basic building block that has been used for a very, very long time. It's been used principally because it is prevalent. We can dig it out of the ground and use it. And it's also beneficial because it's economic compared to some other forms of construction. So predominantly, one of the characteristics around Malta is that you see many of our local buildings all built in this lovely honey-coloured limestone. From an architect's point of view, we have two basic stones, a soft stone, which is the one which we build buildings from, and a harder stone, a lower coralline limestone, which again, in the past, has been used in buildings, and maybe Joanne will speak about it, as a damp-proof course, because they have two different characteristics. But it's the soft limestone which has principally been used in Malta.
We look around and we see these buildings, and they do have this lovely colour. And I think that's one of the things that, despite the fact that we really perhaps are overbuilt on the island, I think something like over 20% of the land in Malta is built on, somehow it doesn't look as bad as it could because we have this particular stone that sort of blends in a little bit to the environment.
It's, as a natural resource, is becoming rather scarce to actually quarry it. So we have seen in recent trends in architecture, a lot of the buildings now are not required by law to be built out of limestone. So we are seeing concrete blocks being used, and the facades of buildings are now plastered or clad. It's not like it was, say, 15 years ago, where it was your facade needed to be built out of limestone. So we are seeing this change in the quality of the architecture. Yes, the local limestone somehow tends to blend in into this chaotic type of vernacular that we have in this country.
Professor Kassar, you are mainly interested in conservation science. You're interested in the historic position and condition of stone in Malta. Where does your research really turn?
as a Department of Conservation and the Built Heritage, we have rather a wide remit. So we actually range, as Professor Bahaja was saying, that the stone has always been used. So we actually start from the archaeology. We start from the prehistoric temples. Our interests start from there because those also have problems. They've got deterioration problems. They've got conservation problems. So we actually go from the archaeological up to even today, because there are buildings today which are built in stone and already have problems. So my personal interest is in stone. As a department, we go much wider than that. We collaborate, for example, a lot with the Department of Classics and Archaeology, where we even supervise dissertations on, we recently had one, for example, characterization of archaeological mortars, which was, I think, hugely successful, because you get this young student who doesn't know anything about science, who really then becomes really good at understanding the concept. We also collaborate with the chemistry department. We collaborate with engineering a lot. We collaborate with engineering. So my interest is primarily on stone characterization. How can we actually identify the type of stone that comes out of the quarry and hopefully predict its behavior, which is something which has been impossible so far, but we're working very hard on it. We have a PhD student at the moment doing that characterization and the durability tests. We also do treatments. So we're looking at the stone and how can we actually stop it from deteriorating or at least slow it down. So we work on salt crystallization inhibitors. We work on stone treatments. We're looking also at linseed oil, which is this famous thing that everybody's applying all over the place. And we've proved that it's actually not the way to go. We had an MSc student. So it's very wide. It's a very wide remit. But it's, well, the key word is stone.
In the document, one of the documents that you gave me so that I could learn a little more about the subject before today, I was interested about this. You touched on it just now, the fact that the stones themselves, there are these two main divisions, but within those divisions, there's great diversity. And now perhaps with a scientific approach, one can actually prevent or foresee that using this particular stone will be detrimental eventually, or it will be just the right one.
That's what we're trying to do. Everybody who just observes, for example, the fortifications, or who actually goes to Hajar Aym, will actually see that they're, you know, buildings built at the same time out of the supposedly same type of stone, areas, locations, courses, stones are behaving very differently from each other. So we know that. We know that Globigerina limestone isn't one homogeneous thing. And this is also natural because it's a natural product. So you cannot have something which comes out of an industry, you know, quality control, discard the old, discard the bad, use the good. So it's a natural product. You quarried in a particular way. So we are actually doing tests to try to predict of the stone which appears homogeneous in the quarry, because quarry workers and workers in the construction industry know that there's a certain type of stone which is blemished, which they automatically discard. So we're not talking of that. We're talking of the stone which seemingly is the same, coming out of the quarry looking exactly the same, but over the years is behaving very differently. And that is one of our, as I said, PhD students who's actually looking at that. How can we identify in the quarry the stone which is then going to perform better?
I was actually at Amnidra only yesterday, with a visitor. And there, I think there are areas, correct me if I'm wrong, where there are exteriors which are hard stone,
yes.
And interiors which are softer, Globigerina, presumably because they were easier to work.
To carve, yes. In fact, in the temples, that is extremely interesting. I mean, we're talking of prehistory here, but we've got a situation where the coralline was typically, not always, it depends on what was available locally, but typically the coralline was used externally, and that's the case in Amnidra, and the Globigerina was used internally. In the case of Gigantea, we've got it mostly coralline, but then we've got the lintels and the doorways, which are made of Globigerina. So we do have this already in prehistory, something which I think, I don't know, maybe we lost over time, but then we're relearning now in a scientific way. But it's, yes, the carved stones are always Globigerina. They're easier to carve.
But they do obviously weather
differently,
more.
Though. I mean, if you go to Hajar Aym, for example, you're looking at the facade, there are some stones which are just in perfect condition. You wouldn't imagine, you know, they're thousands of years old. and others are just crumbling away.
And in a modern context, although Professor Bhajaj has just said that we're not using the stone as much as we were before, we are still building houses with our stone.
Yes, yes, we are. Although our concern when we look at the quarry is the stone which is then used in historical buildings as replacement stone. We're looking primarily at that. How is it going to behave in an environment where it is also in contact with a stone which maybe already has problems? So we're looking at that complex situation rather than, it's, I don't know, Professor Bhajaj can correct me here, but it's easier to build a new place in stone because you can have a dump-proof course, and then you can have a membrane on the roof, and you can use a impermeable mortar. It's easier than if you try to, you know, refit some sort of traditional building.
Because even in the walls, what we call the bastions, there have been replacements.
Yes, sometimes,
stones,
sometimes if you are looking at a structural problem, you don't have a choice. You have to replace the stone. We avoid it as much as possible. The Restoration Directorate, which is taking care of this work, is avoiding it, you know, and trying in most cases to avoid it. But if you have a structural stone, which has virtually been eaten away so that nothing is left, you have no choice.
Your department also is interested in management issues as well,
yes,
not just in the physicality of stone, but also
yes,
managing.
Yes, because my department has, we run various courses. We run an MSc, which is hands-on conservation, but we also run an MSc, which is cultural heritage management. And there, for example, we have a student who's researching conservation management in the Addolorata Cemetery, so he's doing research on how you can have a conservation management plan for that cemetery. So yes, we have very, as I said, we work with archaeology, but we work with engineering. We have a very wide remit, and we're only four people, so.
Yes, perhaps there's a little call there for help.
Yeah, well, no, I'm very happy that we have a lot of support. And considering that just about 3 years ago, I was completely on my own, and now we're four, it's a huge improvement.
An improvement, yes, exactly. And as you get more graduates who will then also do masters and perhaps PhDs, they'll perhaps come back
yeah,
maybe.
Well, yes. Some of the, most of them do teach with us anyway, part-time already. Yeah. We like to involve them, fresh blood, fresh outlook, and to also to encourage them in their studies. So most of them already work with us part-time.
I'd also like to mention the fact of the importance of having PhDs.
Yes.
And masters, definitely, obviously, but also PhDs, because you can do your research
through them,
because obviously you don't have the luxury of being able to just do your research on your own, really. So the research can go on with your direction.
The problem here is funding, and I think Professor Bhajaj and I grumble a lot about this. There's practically no funding for our students, and they have to work full-time, and they have to come in their spare time, and if you do a PhD that way, it's going to take you, you know, half of your life. So I think, I don't know, we need to appeal for funding for our PhD students at least. But also your master's students, I think, are doing a very good job working.
Yes, we have a master's program now that the course has radically changed over the last 5 years. So now it's not just a bachelor's degree, but it's a two-tier course where there's a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. So there is much more opportunity to research at the master's level than there is at the bachelor's level. Having said that, as Professor Kassar has pointed out, I mean, research, fundamental research is always a problem. And as you pointed out, I mean, personally sitting there doing your research, although I wouldn't mind doing it, is very difficult to do. Case in point is the work that I've started off on recycling, well, stone, but also building waste, because it really what we've developed over the last, and this is a research program that has been going on for 4 years in the faculty, started off as a basically a crazy idea, looking at all the building waste that's being dumped in the quarries and saying, well, what can we do with it instead of dumping it? And there have been attempts at recycling the material and trying to make stone again. What we've managed to do in the 4 years is we have come up with a process where we can take this building waste, whether it's stone or concrete, reprocess it, and actually make a building material which we can use to make building blocks. And again, the quality of the appearance, and I think Prof. Kassar will attest to this, because I occasionally go to her room and say, what do you think this material is? it is very close to the limestone that we quarry. The advantage, obviously, of recycling this material is we can re-engineer then the properties of it. I can make it waterproof, I can make it dense, I can make it light, I can make it strong. So it's taking a natural resource which we are actually throwing away and bringing it back into service. As I said, it's been 4 years in the making. We've had 6 dissertations on it. There's another 2 this year. So there's quite a bit of research that's been carried out.
And the reason for doing it is not simply because it's fashionable to recycle, but there are also directives from EU that say we really should be doing it.
By 2020, we will be required by law to recycle a very large proportion of our building waste. We do need to find ways of doing this, and I think this spurred this on. As to how much of it we will recycle, that's a matter of seeing how the process progresses. I mean, the university has just recently submitted a patent on the process, so it is looking at commercializing this process. Where it goes, I'm not sure. But it's taken 4 years, obviously. We've had to look at the natural properties of stone, and the engineered stone we're doing needs to perform like stone or better, if we can, because we have looked at durability issues, and it does turn out to be better than normal stone, although from a conservation point of view, there may be some difficulties, but
some issues there, I can see.
But again, it's good that within the faculty we can discuss these issues and debate.
Absolutely,
and maybe
that's
disagree
what the university
and agree, but
is for.
It has developed into something which I think is interesting.
Where do you get the waste from? Is this waste from, as Professor Kassar was mentioning, waste from quarries? Or are these buildings that are coming down? What kind of waste is it, in fact?
It can be both. I mean, we have so far looked at waste material that's been generated in the quarry, shash, which we use for mortar. So that's already, in a sense, processed to a level that we can work with. And we have also taken blocks which have been quarried and we've carried out physical tests on the blocks and then used the same material, processed it to compare the recycled material with the actual material. What has evolved, which is interesting, is we've actually managed to do the recycling process 4 times. So we've taken the material, broken it down, recycled it, taken the recycled material, broke it down again, and we've not lost anything in terms of strength.
That sounds like good economic sense.
Yes, it could be if we can get the process working. But obviously, it all comes down to economics. And the problem is, people will ask you, is it cheaper than a natural stone? And the answer is obviously no, because you need to collect it, you need to process it, and then you need to reproduce the material. So until we get to the point where there may be these economies, or at least there's a civic, how should I say it, understanding of we're using recycled materials.
But having said that, maybe, I don't know, it's the time to increase the price of quarry stone, because we are running out anyway. So you're comparing to something which is underpriced.
Yes.
So in fact, that's not a fair comparison.
No, that was going to be my next question.
It is underpriced. It is becoming a very limited resource. And I can see that, you know, in the future, as this resource becomes scarcer, then the recycled material may become a viable economic option.
Because people seem to think that somehow this is an endless product and it's going to go on forever, but one can imagine that it's certainly not going to go on forever.
It's not just the product itself, but it's the scars that we leave in the environment. I mean, the quarries are quite a huge scar on our island. So yes, when it becomes scarcer, I think people will start looking to look strongly at recycling this material.
When you go and look for this waste material, does it get crushed and rehashed? How does the process work without getting into the technical details of binders, bindings?
Basically what we do is, and again, the research is focused on looking at the process. And again, there's a lot of research still to be done on the process itself. But we've looked at taking the material and crushing it down, sometimes as fine as the Globigerina was when it was deposited under the sea. And we've looked at grading this, so it could be extremely fine like talc, or it can be coarse, maybe up to 2 millimeters in size. So we've looked at, obviously, how much do we need of each of these. Obviously, the finer it is, then, as I said, we're engineering the material. If it's finer, I can produce a stone that may polish. If it's coarser, then maybe I could use it in a building block, because then I don't need to have the aesthetic qualities that I would need for a fine stone. So you can use, it's a wide range of grading.
But you said you actually can mix the natural stone with concrete, or?
If you take a typical terraced house, which is knocked down, put in a truck and then dumped, we've said, well, what would be the proportion of concrete? What would be the proportion of the stone? And we've taken recycled concrete and blended it in the same sort of proportion and made blocks. So technically, we could make building blocks of this mixture of limestone and concrete. So there are these opportunities.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely fascinating. And it does sound as though it would eventually make economic sense, and maybe not now.
As Professor Kassar said, I mean, research, unfortunately, takes a long time to develop, but then to actually put it, if it's research that you want to put out into the marketplace, it takes even longer to get people to buy that idea. This idea of recycling, and as Prof. Kassar has pointed out, the natural resource is still too cheap compared to what we produce.
Mm. Another kind of recycling, which I come across with some friends of mine who've restored old houses, is trying to get hold of used stone and using it in the restoration process. I mean, is that a good idea? What are the pitfalls of doing that?
Well, it depends if you're considering it scientifically or if you're considering it from an authenticity and a values point of view. Because scientifically, if the stone is good, if it's a good stone, why not reuse it? I mean, it's a pity not to reuse it. And it's proven. It's proven itself. It's lasted so many years and it's still fine. It hasn't deteriorated, so why not? From an authenticity and a values point of view, then you would have issues, because you are then trying to maybe falsify. And in a farmhouse, it's fine. There's no problem. But in a historic building, you do have to be careful, because there is the question of trying to, well, you're attacking the authenticity of the building. You're trying to falsify. And that is something we never do. You have to at least have some sort of document, some way of showing what is new and what is old. And if you try to blend it in too much, then you're then falsifying your building. So scientifically, it's fine. You can build a farmhouse out of recycled stone. Why not? Or even reconstituted stone. There are issues, even for, even for reconstituted stone, there are issues when it comes to restoration. There will be issues. Also because, as Professor Bohajar said, you can make it different. You can make it less porous. You can make it denser. Yeah, but as I said before, you're talking about something which has to work together with the old. And I'm afraid this is going to be working well at the expense of the old if you do make it into such a wonderful material that it never deteriorates. So new build, yes. Old build, careful.
You have your reservations.
Big ones.
A lot of problems have arisen by people using these, linseed oil being a typical example, and other products which are said to be, non-porous, and everyone paints them on the front of their limestone facades with disastrous results, usually with patching and this sort of thing. I mean, how far are we down the road of finding out whether there's any way of making them less porous, or should we not bother at all?
Well, there is obviously a lot of underpinning theory. There is a lot of underpinning theory which states, now all the literature states that you must not in any way try to block the pores when you have an old building, especially a very porous stone in a marine environment, because you are going to increase the problems. So anything which blocks the pores, like linseed oil, for example, should not be used. But there are porous materials which can be used. Usually we go for the traditional materials, lime washes and so on. But there are materials which allow breathability, which is one of the characteristics which we try to emphasize. But not enough research is being carried out locally on these materials. So you're getting a lot of imported materials. And you do get things, but this has worked fantastically in, Sweden. Yes, okay, the climate is slightly different and the stone is slightly different. So we need our local, at least testing, if not research. We need our local testing, which we have no way of doing, at least not It isn't even the role of the university, actually, to do the testing. It isn't. But the basic research, I think, yes, should be carried out here. And, well, sorry, I keep on saying this, but it's the funding again, which is a problem.
If you had a wish list, what kind of funding, what would you fund first? Let's put it that way.
Don't ask me.
What would I fund first?
I'm going to ask you as well, don't worry.
With regards to this project or other interests? I mean, with regards to the Stone project, obviously, I'd like to see it mainstream someday. I mean, the fact that we can take the material and recycle it and keep recycling it, I mean, there's an element of sustainability in it. If we were just to take the material that's in the quarries, I mean, there's enough to make 40 million blocks over I don't know how many times. So there's a lot of sense in it. Funding, obviously, I would like funding to have one or two PhD students who would take this to... I mean, with a dissertation, you can take the research to a certain level. With a PhD student, obviously, it's a process of exploration. You go down a track, you discover something and say, oh, well, what happens if we do this? And then you move sideways or you move forwards. With a dissertation, you have a finite length of time and the resources are limited, so you can't really delve in depth into what you're looking at. So definitely if there was funding available, it would be for PhD students to progress this further.
You as well?
Yes, definitely. And in my particular sphere, I would be looking at trying to find ways not to apply a product and block the deterioration process, but trying to work on the mechanisms of deterioration and slowing those down. And I think with one of our PhD students with salt crystallization inhibitors, we are doing that, except that, again, it's very slow, it's part-time. But I think this is a really interesting field. Many countries, Spain, Italy, are doing a lot of research on these inhibitors. Here, you know, just to repeat what has been done abroad, it takes us about, you know, 3 years part-time, and then to start our own. It's just too slow, and I'm afraid that with all the investment that has taken place, let's say on the fortifications, with all the millions that have been spent, basically they're going to go back to square one unless we do something about slowing down the process, I'm afraid.
Yes, that's quite a hot issue, but I... You know, it's an important issue, and I think that anybody actually looking at them who gives it a bit of thought will have come to the same conclusion. Well, thank you both very much. Thank you to Professor Joanne Kassar and to Professor Dione Bohajar for coming to talk to us about their research work and their courses and their interests in their departments in the faculty for the built environment. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.